Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last night, election night, Republicans seized control of the Senate. And in the House, CNN projects Republicans will have at least 246 seats, its largest majority since World War II. The GOP now has full control of Congress. Citizens across the country voted on 146 important ballot initiatives, affecting everything from abortion restrictions and GMO labeling to the legalization of marijuana and raising the minimum wage. Actually, marijuana and the minimum wage did really well last night. We will talk about that. And then also in California, we voted on six very important propositions. Democrats actually swept statewide offices, and then voters approved the $7.5 billion water bond, the rainy day fund for the state budget, and the measure to reduce some felony drug and property crimes to a misdemeanor. So today we are talking about last night's election results. We'd love to hear from you. What races and issues were you watching closely in your area, and how are you analyzing last night's results? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What's happening in your area? What's really important? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a web comment at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are joined by Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. They closely follow a number of issues, welcome to the including money and politics. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you, Rose. Good to be with you.
Hey, it's great to have you. We're also joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, which sadly shut down a couple of weeks ago. Tim is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper where you can read original work about reporting and arts and culture. Hi, Tim. Thank you for coming
in.
Hi.
Always happy to be on your show.
So we'll talk about the results, but I want to start off by talking about money. And Dave, you follow this closely. Center for Public Integrity has a piece. At least $3.6 billion has been spent on this election. The Sunlight Foundation is coming out with a really interesting look at return on investment, saying that the Republicans did a really good job on their return. The outside groups' spending reached $553 million, 80% higher than similar spending in the 2010 midterm elections. Dave, that's a huge percentage.
Well, it's a huge percentage, and of course, the overall number seems quite gaudy, but pretty much every midterm election cycle, every election cycle, we're always deeming it to be the most expensive race, the most expensive midterm in U.S. history, and 2014 is no exception. But it's how the money is being spent that is incredibly curious, particularly when we look at the U.S. Senate and the critical races that decided ultimately that the Republicans were going to control the Senate. We saw a very interesting phenomenon. Oftentimes, Democratic candidates were raising and spending more money, even a lot more money, than the Republican counterparts. But where Republicans were able to capitalize in a major, major way is sort of getting the cavalry to ride in on their behalf. And when we say the cavalry, we mean super PACs and nonprofit organizations and different types of outside groups that, ever since several key court decisions in the past few years, most notably the Citizens United decision, they all have the ability to raise and spend effectively unlimited amounts of money in politics. So as a result, the Republicans were much more successful in some of these key races than Democrats, marshaling that kind of support, that kind of money, and effectively getting it to close a gap that they had, a fundraising gap, with Democratic candidates who were more successful as individual candidates, by and large, raising money for their own campaigns.
According to the Sunlight Foundation, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee spent $65 million on the midterms. They had a 34% success rate. And the National Republican Congressional Committee spent $63 million, a little less, but they had a 78% success rate.
And they had a great organization. The Republicans did, and being able not only to fundraise but also execute a ground game, work with candidates. Another interesting factor too, which is quite related, is outside groups that are not part of the political party structure per se. By law, they can't coordinate with candidates, but at the same time are so closely aligned with them, they may as well be. Senate Majority PAC, which was a Democratic super PAC, is a Democratic super PAC. It produced more television ads than any other super PAC during the 2014 election. Their success rate, they played in nine races, Senate races across the country. They the candidate that they were supporting in those nine races only won two times, lost six times, and then Louisiana is going to a runoff, and that'll be decided in a few weeks. And then on the other hand, you have the Crossroads groups. Those are super PAC, American Crossroads, its sister nonprofit organization, Crossroads GPS. This is the group that was co-founded by Carl Rove and Ed Gillespie, who himself was a Senate candidate in Virginia. They had effectively the opposite rate. They won in six races in which they played, and they lost in two. With two more undecided. So, really the Republicans had a great deal of success across the board and ultimately were better playing the Citizens United game than Democrats were, even though Democrats have in a major way embraced the powers that the Citizens United decision has given all political actors, regardless of their partisan leanings.
And Tim, here in California, millions of dollars were spent on the Proposition 45, which went down, which would have given the insurance commissioner the right to tell health insurance companies that they have no justification for raising rates. The health insurance industry spent about $50 million on that. And then even in San Francisco, we were inundated with the voter flyers, vote on this, don't vote on that. A lot of money was spent at the state and city levels.
A lot of money was spent, and a lot of money was spent in a different way than we have seen, in a way that we're seeing increasingly, but in a different way that we've seen in the past. I mean, there was a lot of insurance company money, obviously, fighting Prop 45. In some of these races, there was significant amounts of labor money. But those are actors that you can really identify. And, you know, labor unions are made up of members, and each member gives a certain amount of money. And there's a certain diffusion of power involved there. With the insurance industry, obviously, it's different, but you can see they vote, they contributed this money. You know who it is. What we saw in San Francisco is we saw races where just a couple of individuals, two tech billionaires, Reid Hoffman and Ron Conway, together spent more than $500,000 on one assembly race. Now, that's two individuals, two people who, if David Chu wins, can claim that they helped buy the 17th Assembly District by themselves with no accountability to anybody, no accountability to members, no accountability to consumers, no accountability to anybody at all. And they also, one of the things these outside groups can do is they can be a lot nastier. If a candidate for office sends out a flyer accusing his or her opponent of something really awful, people can go to that candidate and say, how can you say this? But in this case, for example, we had outside groups accusing David Campos of everything from being a sellout to big oil to being a supporter of domestic violence and all of that. And when people went to David Chu and said, how can you say this sort of stuff? He was able to say, oh, it's not me. I got nothing to do with it. It's these other guys who have no connection with my campaign who are just spending this money doing nasty attacks. So part of the Citizens United thing is just the overall level of nastiness that has come out of this.
And the results in that race are still...
The results in that race, the results all over San Francisco, particularly in the Campos-Chu race, which is very, very close, are still to be determined. I mean, there were 160-something thousand votes cast that have been counted so far. There are, the director of elections informed me this morning, another 61,000 votes still to be counted, and that includes 8,000 absentee votes that arrived on election day, 42,000 absentee votes that were dropped off at the polls on election day, and 11,000 provisional ballots. So that's a lot of votes. And in a race that's only a couple of percentage points, that could change. We won't know, we may not know the result of that until next week.
And that is Tim Redmond. He is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive online newspaper. Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And we're talking about last night's results. Some of the results are still coming in. We'd love to hear from you. What happened in your area? What were you watching closely? And how are you analyzing what happened last night? 866-798-8255. There were so many important things. The soda tax, the marijuana, I think across three states. Marijuana actually did really well last night. Oregon became the third state in the country to legalize marijuana. D.C. voters, Washington, D.C. voters, legalized marijuana. Now it's, you can get high in the nation's capital. Bernalillo County, New Mexico, passed marijuana decriminalization with 56% of the vote. Minimum wage also did well. Arkansas approved minimum wage. It's $6.25 an hour in Arkansas, one of the lowest rates in the country. It'll be $8.50 by 2017. It also passed in South Dakota, Nebraska, and then here in San Francisco. It's going to be $15 over the next 3 years.
Yes, and in fact, what we're seeing is this is actually a strategy that a lot of organized labor groups and others who support a higher minimum wage are pursuing, which is, you know, with the Republicans in power in Washington and even before the Republicans controlled the Senate, we were never going to get good minimum wage legislation nationally. It's just impossible to get the Republicans to do it, even though that's something that's extremely popular among both Democrats and Republicans, but the Republicans in Congress aren't going to do it. So what the supporters of minimum wage have done is gone to cities and to states. And, you know, there's a minimum wage around the Bay campaign that organized labor is taking on. They won in San Francisco and I believe in Berkeley. And there's going to be minimum wage campaigns in other cities. So what people are saying is if we can't get it out of Congress, we're going to have to get it locally. And I think on a lot of progressive types of legislation, we're going to see that over the next 2 years. I think people are going to say, okay, when it comes to anything good in this country, it isn't going to come out of Washington. Hmm. It just isn't. So let's try to work at the state level and at the local level.
Well, what are your thoughts on that, Dave? I mean, we haven't yet talked about what happened in Washington. We will. But now that the Republicans control Congress, what is going to happen in the next 2 years?
Well, first of all, you will not have a divided House and Senate, so it's entirely possible that you could be having more pieces of legislation going to Barack Obama's desk. And he's been a president who is oftentimes never had to face vetoes to exact a veto, to make a veto, because simply legislation would get tied up in Congress. He would never have to deal with that. Expect that to change to some degree at the national level. But going back to the state houses, this is an incredibly important point. So much of the action that's taking place legislatively on issues, pocketbook issues that affect people in their respective states, social issues that affect people in their states, the action is not happening here in Washington, D.C., where I'm calling you from. The action is happening in Sacramento. The action is happening in Albany. The action is happening in Austin. It's the state capitals around the country in all 50 states where truly a lot of movement is taking place, or at least more movement than's happening in Washington, D.C. on the same types of issues. So look to the state capitals for some big-time issues to play out over the next couple of years, particularly if the gridlock in Congress here in Washington, D.C. is not coming in the form of internal congressional gridlock, but gridlock between the White House and Congress.
Yeah. Okay, so minimum wage, marijuana. Let's talk about GMO labeling. This is a big one. GMO labeling lost in California last time around. It went down in Colorado. The votes are still being counted in Oregon, and the big food and biotech forces have spent about $33 million opposing our right to know if what we're eating has GMOs, and then the yes side raised about $9 million. Anything on that one? So it went down in Colorado. We're still waiting on Oregon.
Well, again, we're seeing the vast difference in spending. And we're also seeing, on issues like that. And for example, we can talk more about the health insurance measure in California. Mm. One of the things that we're seeing is as the traditional news media are shrinking, and as the number of reporters out there covering these issues is shrinking, there's less to contradict the inaccurate information. I really do think that, I look back to Prop 103 in 1987 or 88, whenever that was, that the insurance industry spent $100 million on a car insurance measure and lost. Well, at that time, every newspaper in the state was writing about car insurance rates. And everybody was talking about what Prop 103 really did and what it didn't do. And that gave the supporters, who included, consumer advocates and Ralph Nader, it gave them a chance to at least get their message out. I saw much less reporting on Prop 45 and on Prop 46 and on what these measures actually do. And I do think that that's a result of declining newsrooms. There's just not people out there who have the time to do this. So I think that consumers are getting less unbiased information, less fact-checked information, and they're relying more on these multi-million-dollar ad campaigns. And really, if you're hearing three times as many ads from one side as the other, and if they're manipulative and misleading but well-crafted, it's very, very tough to go up against that.
That is Tim Redmond, founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper. Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. They do really good work, especially on money and politics. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on what happened last night? We're still getting some results, and we probably won't even get all of them over the next couple days. But we'd love to hear from you. What happened in your area? What were you closely watching? What are you happy about? What are you disappointed about? And how do you really analyze what happened last night? Again, Republicans seized control of the Senate. CNN is projecting that Republicans will have at least 246 seats in the House, the largest majority since World War II. The GOP now has full control of Congress. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And you can email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Locally, I was depressed that Prop G, the rental protection flipper law, didn't pass, and natural grass in Golden Gate Park didn't pass. Nationally, I wonder, my own personal approach, since I have a whole box of recycling stuff that came in the mail, my approach this time was not to read any of it, and I strictly went by the voter information pamphlet and the very underused and unheralded independent legislative analyst. And I'm curious, what do your experts think sways public opinion? Because I just have a sense that the public is stupid and they want simple, sound-bited, easy-to-digest craziness. Before I forget to mention it, I have a very conservative cousin who forwards me all these silly emails, what I call office crap, the kind of stuff people pass around at work. And I'm amazed at how dumb the conservative things are, but they appear to work. It's usually something just making fun of government workers or the federal government can't do anything right. And by association, Obama and anyone that has ever supported anything, he's tried to legislate. And I really think that it's a gossipy world of reality TV and scurrilous political ads. And I really have little faith in my fellow voters in terms of sorting out the truth. And I wish journalists would confine themselves not to broadcasting stupid, self-serving press releases, essentially, from candidates, and really do fact-finding and say where the truth is. Mm. We don't have enough people to sort out the truth, and the websites
Not only that, Ken, but I mean, if you live in San Francisco, and I'd love to hear from you if you live on the peninsula, Santa Cruz, Marin. I mean, here in San Francisco, we had 11 propositions, and then we had 5 state propositions. We had at least, 8 judges to vote on? I mean, the ballot was 3 sheets long, and it's a long sheet.
4 sheets long.
4 sheets long, front and back. And so, I mean, I had people say, I don't even know what's happening in terms of half the city measure. So we've got that, too.
We've got that, too. And as I say, we've got the decline in the number of reporters in the mainstream media covering this stuff. And I think we've got a lot of voter confusion because there's a decline. I mean, there's a decline in the number of kind of reliable sources that people can turn to. I mean, the traditional slates. I mean, the Democratic Party, for example, in San Francisco, a lot of Democrats used to say, okay, well, if the Democratic Party's for it, I'm for it. The Democratic Party was so divided this time and took such, unusual positions on some measures. And, the Democratic Party slate card, for example, instead of saying that Prop G was an anti-speculation tax or a fight the evictions thing, it says additional tax on residential property. That doesn't sound very good. The ballot statements that were actually put on in the ballot handbook for Proposition G didn't say anti-speculation tax. It said additional tax on residential property. That doesn't sound too good. So, between all of these things and the fact that our caller's right, I mean, I think in the last 4 days of the election, I got 50 different mailers.
Right.
And I read them all because I'm crazy and that's my job and I look at them all. But I think between all of that, oh, this guy's a bum. Oh, that guy's a bum. Oh, don't vote for this one. Oh, don't vote for that. Oh, if you vote for this, the world is going to end. Oh, if you vote for this, your taxes are going to go up. I think a lot of people just got really confused. And what happens when the voters get confused? They vote no.
Or they don't vote.
Or they don't vote.
Right.
Or they don't vote. Or they just say, I can't decide which one. Or they go and they vote for governor and then they skip the rest of the ballot.
Well, and Dave, I'm still waiting for voter turnout. There's very few articles about this. I did find one in Ohio saying that voter turnout hit historic lows in Ohio. And so that's also an important piece of this puzzle. Like, how many people actually came out to vote?
It is, and it's spotty. Really depends on the state in the race. But I think the caller made a good point about ballot measures that I wanted to address. You know, they're strange animals. If you've got a congressional race, if you've got a Senate race, a gubernatorial race, you have real, live, breathing people. You can talk about Jerry Brown. You can talk about Barack Obama. You can talk about Mitch McConnell. But with ballot measures, you're dealing with oftentimes these amorphous issues and how many people are really going to get all hot and bothered about, you know, bonds for water projects. Not a whole lot necessarily. So as a result, you have special interests who do very much care about these issues because they have a lot of money at stake, pumping in an incredible amount of cash to try to sway the electorate, which may not necessarily be all that informed on the issue at hand or not have a person to attach it to, not have sort of a face for the issue that's in play. And on publicintegrity.org, our site, all election season, we've been tracking ballot measures in particular because we feel that that there is a lot at stake there and that there's so much money going into them. In California alone, there were 5 of the top 10 ballot measures across the country that were in California in terms of the number of ads that were run and the expense that went into it. We're talking millions, in some cases, tens of millions of dollars that went behind individual ballot measure propositions. Mm-hmm. And that's some serious cash that's rivaling U.S. Senate races.
Yeah.
And these are state-level ballot measures. This is big political business, make no mistake about it.
Right.
And sometimes exceeding what they spend on Senate races.
Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Ken. Let's go to another caller before break. Martha in Oakland. Hi, Martha. Welcome to the show.
Hi. If this is me.
Yes, go ahead.
Hi. I want, first of all, to thank you and Tim and then add the East Bay Express. You're what I count on for integrity and to at least get some of the information out. I don't know what happened. We all voted in my little district. We had our... we saw all the things the mayor put out that she'd done, and we didn't get a thing from the person who was elected mayor. But even more important, the question I wanted to ask you was, how come no one is paying any attention from Barack Obama down? I haven't in all these years heard him mention the non-working poor, the old, the disabled, and a little bit the veterans, but we lost money, and then the Rainey Fund means that it's not going to be restored. Who is speaking out for us? Nate Miley, some, but he wasn't up for re-election. But that's a problem, and I hope that you people will look into it because we're the best hope, we old people who have no money and are on a fixed retirement that's going down the tubes. So you're all we've got. So thank you for being there, and I hope you do more.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Martha, and I'll get a response from our guests because we have to take a quick break. And we'd love to hear from you. How are you analyzing last night's results? What were you watching in your area? And what are your thoughts on what happened last night? This is your call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways you can join in today's conversation with Rose Aguilar on your call. On the phone, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Email, the address is feedback@yourcallradio.org, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, the world have your say from the BBC. Today, should a woman's right to choose include the right to drink when pregnant? A local council in the UK is seeking compensation for a 6-year-old girl whose disability was caused by her mother's drinking during pregnancy. It's caused a big debate online on the rights and responsibilities of pregnancy. Is any level of drinking or smoking acceptable during pregnancy, and whose business is it? That's World Have Your Say, coming up at 11.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative and author of the memoir Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. Can individual stories help create a more merciful justice system? One in every 15 people in the U.S. is expected to go to jail or prison. For black men, the number increases to 1 in 3. So Brian Stevenson will be joining us in studio tomorrow, and then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're talking about last night's election. How are you analyzing what happened? We'd love to hear about what happened in your area. How many local propositions did you vote on? What passed? What didn't? Are you disappointed? Are you happy about what happened in your area? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And also, if you didn't vote, we'd love to hear from you, because I'm still waiting for voter turnout, thinking it's probably pretty low. Tim, in San Francisco, it's about 37%.
That's what I saw. It's about 37%. But on the other hand, more than a quarter of the ballots haven't been counted yet.
Okay.
But even so, even if we get up to 50%, which people will say is, gee, in a midterm election, that's great. That means half the people didn't vote.
Yeah.
You know, we're just talking about the previous caller and how, you know, poverty is just not an issue. It was just not an issue in the midterm elections. Mm-hmm. And I think that because it was not an issue, and because, you know, the Republicans ignored it or said that poor people are just lazy, and the Democrats didn't really offer a cogent alternative. I mean, who was really talking about not cutting Social Security, but raising Social Security? Who was talking about raising payments to people who are on fixed incomes? Nobody. So I think there's probably a lot of people who are just desperate and in poverty and just look around and say, as the caller did before, who's speaking for us?
Mm-hmm.
Who's speaking for me? Why should I go out and vote? Because there's nobody there speaking for me. And you know, if a lot of those people all over the country came out and voted, I think we'd see different results than we're seeing now.
That is Tim Redmond, founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper, and Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. What are your thoughts on this, Dave, talking about the poor, the elderly, people who are struggling, veterans?
And when you say that, do you mean in terms of voter turnout or
The fact that these issues were really missing from the national conversation?
Sure. Well, you know, this has been, in large part, especially at the national level, an election about fear. Everything from military action, terrorism, Ebola became a politicized issue. Many of these issues were sort of the top tier issues that were getting talked about, particularly late in the game. So sometimes the more nuts and bolts issues of politicking, they will become secondary, even tertiary issues during the course of a campaign when you have sort of bigger, bolder, sexier issues that are grabbing headlines and also the attention of the candidates themselves. Plus, if people are scared about something, fear is a motivator. They want to hear from the candidates about the issue du jour that is scaring them at the moment, and not necessarily about the inner workings of Social Security or something that's going to deal with a taxation issue that may not affect them for years and years. It just, in a way, is human nature, but at the same time, a lot of people are, of course, frustrated that these nuts and bolts issues, which are very, very important in their own right oftentimes, don't get the kind of play and the kind of attention that they would hope they would get, because they are, like we talked about before, pocketbook issues that affect people in a very personal way.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling, Martha. Let's go next to Suzanne in Richmond. Hi, Suzanne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I want to say something about, I know that not everything, we're not very happy about what happened nationally, perhaps, but in Richmond, all of the progressives won. The Team Richmond, the three people running for city council, even though we're up against $3 million that Chevron put into the fight, and we basically had no money. We did our walking door-to-door and our phone banking just as volunteers, and people who Chevron put up $3 million and paid people to do those sorts of things. Anyway, we have a new progressive mayor, Tom butt, and we have three city council people who are the progressives. And we did it all just walking and talking and painting over our signs when the other side trashed them. We had three billboards, I think, in town. All the rest of the billboards were bought up by Chevron, and they included not only ads for their candidates, but nasty smear ads against our people.
Hmm.
So we're pretty excited.
and you should be excited. Congratulations. That was definitely a highlight in a relatively bleak national election, what happened in Richmond. And, you know, part of what happened, I think, was a tremendous, as the caller said, a tremendous grassroots on-the-ground effort. Part of it was, I think, that the Richmond progressives were able to get the word out that this was Chevron. And I think they were able to say, all of this money is coming from one company that wants to own this town. And I think that's a very effective message. It succeeded in Richmond. Now, Richmond is a smaller city than, say, San Francisco, certainly smaller than the state of California. And it's easier to do that kind of retail grassroots work when you have a smaller population that you're dealing with. But I mean, what happened in Richmond is a bright spot, and we all ought to look at that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. We have an email from Mark who says, in much of the country, especially red states, people supported progressive positions on ballot initiatives and the candidates who oppose them. For example, minimum wage and marijuana. What's up with that? Dave?
It's a bizarre phenomenon of this election. Yeah, increase the minimum wage, legalize marijuana, and let's vote Republican. It really doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to a lot of people, and there's been a whole lot of chatter today. All you got to do is just type in those couple of words, and then you're going to get article after article, blog item after blog item about this very topic of where people, particularly on social issues, where there may have been a ballot proposition, a ballot measure, were voting in a way that would seem to logically cut against somebody voting for a Republican candidate. But that's the nature of local issues versus national issues, too. A lot of people do see their local issues, their homegrown issues, and perhaps a little bit of a different light than they would national issues that are taking place in on the ground here in Washington, D.C. That's 3,000 miles away if you're in California. Washington can seem like a very, very far away place to a lot of people, not just in terms of physical distance, but also philosophically as well. So in a way, some voters may be looking at national levels and local levels in a slightly different way and doing things that to a political scientist, for example, may not seem all that logical, but makes sense to the voter.
Well, there's also, I think, the fact that while you say people were voting to legalize marijuana and then voting for a Republican who opposes that position, in a lot of parts of the country, the Democrats didn't talk about legalizing marijuana either.
Yeah.
Here we have in California, our governor of California, Jerry Brown, is against legalizing marijuana because he says we can't compete with China if we're all stoned. I mean, he literally said that. That was Jerry Brown's comment on legalizing marijuana. Even I have found in the state legislature, Democrats are afraid of this issue. So, the public is in favor of this, and then they look at, there's a Democrat who's against it, and there's a Republican who's against it. So
I think also to the issues, if I may add, sometimes you do have Republicans, certainly those with a more libertarian streak, who are very pro-pot. You will have Democrats who, like Jerry Brown being an example, who like the idea of a certain system, but in reality they really don't want to go for it in a political sense. And the minimum wage too, like we talked about a little bit before, on a national level it's a total non-starter. On the local level, it's very much a starter to a point where cities, municipalities, states are just going and doing their own thing when it comes to the minimum wage. And oftentimes that's driven by Democrats, but there's a good deal of Republican support, too. So it's not always as red and blue, neat and clean as people might think it is. There are shades of purple when it comes to particular issues like this.
Hmm. Well, we talked about minimum wage, GMOs, and marijuana. I just want to quickly talk about abortion because the personhood ballot initiatives and basically personhood says that the fetus is a person failed in Colorado and North Dakota. So there were two of those across the country. But in Tennessee, voters backed by a solid margin, a measure that gives state lawmakers more power to restrict and regulate abortions. And a lot of people are watching this because it's a very strict amendment.
And this is an issue that if we were having this conversation 10 or 15 years ago, I think most people would consider it to be very much a national issue. Today, a lot of what's happening is happening either at the state level or in the courts. And that's where the focus of anything to do with abortion really is. You don't see necessarily this issue rising even to the top 3, 5, 10 issues in the minds of some federal lawmakers, but is very much on the minds of people in a variety of states. And a state like Texas, for example, would be a perfect example of where this had dominated the discourse over the past couple of years at the state level and in the Texas legislature. So I look again too for this particular issue to be more of a state's issue perhaps in the next couple of years than it even has been in the most recent years.
Well, and you also have, again, with this, the phenomenon we were talking about earlier. I mean, Colorado, for example, where voters rejected the personhood amendment, but also rejected the Democrats. You know, people voted for Republicans in Colorado who, with the Republican majority, I mean, you look at who the Republican leadership is right now. These are people who are very much anti-choice and have no interest whatsoever in women's rights.
Well, and Joni Ernst, Joni Ernst. I didn't hear much of this in the coverage of her at all last night, but she opposes abortion even in cases of rape and incest.
Yes, and that's really where the Republican...
She's now senator from Iowa.
And that's really where the Republican Party is going right now. And I think we have a lot of voters who, again, they may have voted because they're afraid of ISIS or Ebola, but they didn't really think about the fact that these Republicans are actually going to change, if Obama lets them, are going to pass a lot of legislation that's really going to hurt a lot of people. And it's going to hurt a lot of people, you know, starting in the pocketbook.
Well, so just quickly, Dave, what strikes you about the Republicans who won last night? I mean, Joni Ernst is getting a lot of attention because of her pig castration commercial, basically saying she's going to go to Washington and get rid of the pork. But, I mean, her views are extreme. She wants to get rid of the EPA, the Department of Education, the IRS. She still believes in weapons of mass destruction. I mean, a lot of this stuff didn't come out at all in the coverage of Joni Ernst.
But what she doesn't like is Barack Obama, and that was an issue that resonated time and time again, whether you like it or not, in Senate races all across the country and House races. Barack Obama was one of the marquee, if not the marquee issue in the 2014 election, even though he wasn't on the ballot and he's never running for election again. And the Republicans did, in a way, a masterful job of taking issues like we've been talking about and making them secondary factors and making President Obama the star of 2014 and making this, in a way, a referendum on Barack Obama and his policies and the Affordable Care Act and everything else that's happened over the past couple of years. And that resonated with Republican voters. That resonated with conservatives who were very upset with the way that the president has handled himself over the past couple of years. And perhaps it depressed Democratic voters and liberal voters from coming to the polls and the kind of numbers that were needed for Democrats to win. It's something that is going to be talked about for months to come from a strategy standpoint, but at least in the initial offing here, you did definitely see time and again examples of where this took place. And all you got to do is look at all the television ads that went up in all of these races. We counted quite literally hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of TV ads that mentioned either President Obama or Obamacare in them, being sponsored by Republicans or Republican groups in a way that says it all.
And the oddity of this is Barack Obama is hardly a radical leftist, and he certainly hasn't done anything in the last couple of years that would be radically moving the country to the left, because the Republicans haven't let him. I mean, basically, the Republicans in the House, their entire strategy is to make it impossible for Obama to govern. And then they go out there and say, this guy isn't doing anything good. Well, he hasn't been able to do anything good because the Republicans have blocked and have really been obstructionist. So I think that you know, the president was unable to get that message across, that actually this is what I want to do and the Republicans are blocking me. And he was unable to connect with people because I think he didn't try hard enough to come out and say, I mean, look at immigration reform. You know, he promised immigration reform. He promised immigration reform. And then he told people, oh, after the election, I'll do something on immigration reform. All right. I think a lot of people, you know, are the natural constituency for Obama may have been frustrated and said, why are we going to go out? And in the meantime, the Republicans are able to go out there and attack this guy for problems that they have created.
The American Conservative magazine has a huge feature story on Obama's policies. This is the American Conservative magazine. It says Obama's 6 years in office mark the presidency of a moderate conservative, not a liberal.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly say if he's a liberal, he's been an incredibly hesitant liberal, hesitant to push anything, you know, and certainly has not come out strongly with a progressive agenda in the last couple of years. Now, again, you can say it would be pointless because he couldn't get anything through the House. You could certainly say that. On the other hand, he's the president of the United States and has a certain amount of power. And maybe, you know, his advisor said, I'm sure, don't do anything on immigration that the Republicans can use against you. On the other hand, they used everything against him anyway. Perhaps if he'd come out and taken executive action on a path for citizenship and to stop some of the deportations, he might have gotten more voters out. More voters might have come to support Democrats.
From a political standpoint, he was invisible up until the very end. He wasn't campaigning for candidates in key states. He wasn't going state by state and having the big public rallies that he was so well known for during his 2008 election and again his reelection. He was really invisible, and sure, he'd go to some big dollar fundraiser here or there and headline the event, but pretty much even the Democrats themselves were running away from Obama for fear that being linked too closely to him was going to be toxic for their chances. Alison Lundergan Grimes, who is running against Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, famously did this in a series of television ads where she was shooting a gun. So President Obama, as he thinks about, well, what could we have done to improve this, maybe thinking very hard about just simply going out there and doing what he does and does quite well, which is campaign and own the issues that he's put out. He didn't do that, and we see the results of the election today.
Dave Leventhal is senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, and Tim Redmond is founder of 48 Hills, a progressive daily online newspaper. On today's Your Call, we are talking about last night's results. What happened in your area, and how are you analyzing what happened last night? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Carol writes in, more fans turned out for the Giants parade than voted in the land of the free, which will become less free on January 3rd, 2015. She writes, yay for Richmond, one of the few places where money did not talk. And again, Carol, we're still waiting for voter turnout. Hopefully we can talk about that just briefly on tomorrow's show. Thank you for writing in. Let's go to Anonymous in Berkeley. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Boy, so much is happening in Berkeley. It's hard to pick one thing to talk about. But I guess I wanted to draw people's attention to our city council and mayor. It's Mayor Tom Bates is a former assembly person, and he's gone from being like on the left to actually pretty conservative. And the majority of the city council is actually pretty conservative, too. There are three members that are would be considered progressive. And one of them, Chris Worthington, was under major attack. They put up a candidate who sent out tons of mailers against Chris. And, like, every other week, I felt like I was getting one. And Chris is someone who worked full-time as a city council person. And the opponent is someone who's going to maintain a full-time job, it looks like. So he's not going to have a lot of time for city, you know, issues. Also, Chris's district, along with a lot of other districts, are being gerrymandered. And one thing, there was a Measure R, and it was put up by a community group to, there's going to be, let me make sure I get this, 1,400 housing units are going to be built in downtown Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And Measure R was asking that the developers are going to make huge money because, you know, they can ask a high price for them. And Measure R was asking for, well, automatically, if someone builds right by BART, a developer gets the green, you know, gold standard. And we were asking for even higher standards, so the platinum standard, and the developers were saying it was going to be too cost prohibitive. I don't know if I said this, but we were outspent 14 to 1, and we were walking our flyers to people because we didn't have enough money to mail them. We were also asking for, like, affordable housing to be built, and
Well, no, thank you so much for calling in. We just have a full lines, and I just want to get to more people. But thanks for letting us know what's happening in Berkeley. And if you have any information you want to send us, I can pass that on to our news team. So thank you for calling. Let's go next to Ray in El Cerrito. Hi, Ray.
Hi there. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I just had a few things that I took out of the results of last night. The first is I've always thought that it's interesting. I'm not a native Californian, but I've always enjoyed in some ways that California is the only state that gives its voters homework. And we had a test last night, and I think we mostly passed the test. The second thing I'm reminded of is with the bloodbath of Democratic losses throughout the country, it reminded me of a grim Stalinist joke that people used to tell in Russia, that they'd have fewer Russians, that they'd have better Russians. Maybe we'll have fewer Democrats, but we'll have better Democrats down the road. And then the third thing is that I think one silver lining that comes out of it is as if we needed to have it proven, is that money in elections clearly is not buying the quality of elections. Mm. And I think the Richmond election is really showing that.
Hmm.
But I think the fourth and probably the most troubling thing that comes out of the election is that it's just showing a continual mean streak in American politics, where we're polarized terribly, and it's because I think one reason is there's no shared sacrifice asked. We've had two wars since the year 2000, and yet most people, I think, don't have regular interaction with veterans. There's no shared sacrifice that's asked of Americans that there was asked for the other wars that America had fought, like World War II. And so with that no shared experience, that leads to a lot of polarization. That's why we have these intractable issues like the health care debate and the immigration. And I just only think that's only going to get worse, especially when you continue to pour money in there and ensure that there will be a poor quality of elections down the road.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to look at that silver linings in Richmond and see what happened there to make that work and figure out how we can carry that to a larger state.
Well, yeah, I was thinking actually it would be interesting to do a show about what happened in Richmond. So thank you so much. You also might want to go to Vote Vets website because they did a lot of outreach. They ran a lot of commercials, you know, talking about veterans' issues and how they're still really struggling to get basic care when they return. So thank you so much for calling in. We have time for a few more callers. Let's go to Jean in San Anselmo. Hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say that it was very hard for me to find any information about the judges who are up for Court of Appeals.
Yeah.
And that was really lacking. And I do miss our newspapers like the Bay Guardian. And good luck, Tim, with 48 Hills.
Well, thank you.
We need more information out there, good information.
Thanks. You know, I actually heard that from a lot of people, that people didn't even know that there were judges on the ballot. So you got your first page of the ballot, and you filled it out, and then you flip it over, and the entire other side is all of these judges' reconfirmation elections. And no one, I haven't seen a single article explaining to people that these judges were on the ballot or what that's all about. What that's all about, of course, is that every 10 years, all of the Supreme Court and appellate court judges come up for reconfirmation. But I don't think people understood it a lot. I think a lot of people just looked at it and said, what is this?
Why did this happen? Because I noticed that I looked at the Guardian slate, the Green Party slate, the Conservation, you name it. None of them had
judges. Nobody mentioned anything about the judges. Yeah.
Now, one political junkie friend said that she did find a conservative site that chose their judges, and she basically did her research and then voted the opposite way. That's how she did it.
Yeah.
But she couldn't find any information on the judges.
No,
and you're
I
right,
know.
I think we had to vote on about eight of them.
There were a lot, and you know, it raises a lot of important questions. These judicial races are actually important because it raises the question of, you know, should the voters be deciding on appellate-level judges all over the country? There have been been, I think in Minnesota, the single most expensive race was for the Supreme Court. And that's kind of a scary thought when you think that the same people who are trying to buy politicians are now trying to buy judges. So this is actually a really interesting and difficult question that there was no attention to at all.
Yeah, just quickly, Dave, McClatchy had a piece, Increase in Big Money Influencing Judicial Elections. So a lot of money was poured into judges.
But not in California. There were none of them campaigned. I mean, nobody knew who any of these folks were or whether we should be for them or against them.
And that may be somewhat of an exception to the rule, because we've definitely seen in other states examples, not only the one that you cite, but plenty of others, where there's been an incredible amount of money that have been poured into judicial races, very, very competitive contests that will attract six, even seven figures worth of money in a single election for a judge's race. And so much is at stake, too. We've had a project that's focused simply on the judiciary, conflicts of interest, and various other issues that should be of concern to anyone who ever might have an opportunity or a chance, good or bad, to go before a judge. These are serious, serious issues and serious races, even if they are fairly low profile because of all the other congressional and gubernatorial and ballot measure races that are on the ballot as well. A three-page ballot can be pretty daunting, and once you get to page three and are looking at a bunch of names that you don't recognize, it's probably not going to be at the top of your list either.
Well, thank you. We have an email from Laura who quoted Robert Reich, former Labor Secretary under Clinton, who says, I'm less worried Republicans will roll back the Affordable Care Act or reduce taxes on the wealthy than I am about Obama joining with Republicans to approve Keystone or the chained CPI that would reduce Social Security payments. Obama has either sought these in the past or hinted he would, and he and McConnell and Boehner will be so eager to show they can work together that they will that these will prove irresistible, end quote. Tim, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think there's a certain extent to which, I mean, Obama had already said, even before Election Day, he set a meeting for Friday with the Republican congressional leaders, because I think he saw this coming. And he is going to, I guarantee, on Friday, they're all going to stand there and say, okay, we're all going to work together. We're going to find areas of common ground and common interest. And while, what I worry is that the Republicans will take that as, okay, we're going to push this stuff as far as we can possibly go. And Obama's going to say, well, I got to do some of it.
Quick thoughts, Dave?
You're probably going to have a combination of both. As I said at the outset of the show, I expect him to use his veto, or at least to threaten vetoes, a heck of a lot more than he ever had to when the Congress was split and there wasn't much of legislation of any note going forward. But at the same time, too, if the president is seen as an obstructionist, that could have implications for 2016 and the Democrats in general. So a lot of politics that are going to be overarching here over the next couple of years.
Dave Leventhal, senior political reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. Tim Redmond, founder of 48 Hills, a progressive online paper. Thank you both for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Can individual stories help create a more merciful justice system? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Brian Stevenson, founder of the Equal Justice Initiative and author of Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption. One in every 15 people in the U.S. is expected to go to jail or prison. For black men, the number increases to one in three. So how can we generate empathy for people who've committed crimes and compassion for victims? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.